You know that thing where you get an amazing pair of shoes at a really great price and want to tell everyone about it? Yeah, so do we. Here at Designer Shoe Warehouse, we'll give you something to brag about. Like the latest styles from brands you love, or the trends everyone's obsessing over, or shoes that make you feel like, well, you. So go ahead, show off a little. Find shoes that get you at prices that get your budget. Head to your DSW store or DSW.com today. DSW, let us surprise you.
Welcome to another edition of the It's Cavalier Podcast. It's your boy, Mac. Joining me today is my good friend, Luca, or as you guys know him, real Cavs fans operating over there. How you doing, Luca?
Doing good. Wish I was joining you in better circumstances, but here we are.
I mean, I think everybody, and this is all dependent on personal expectation, right? After the acquisitions that the Cavaliers made around the deadline, everybody began to formulate their own personal expectations of where this team needed to reach or how far this team needed to go in order to justify not only that move, but to feel like the season itself was a step in the right direction, or rather a success, which we actually heard Kenny chime in on. We'll get to that in a little bit. But you already know, man, there's so much going on in only 24 hours after. It probably wasn't even a full 24 after Cleveland was eliminated via the sweep. The Cavaliers decided that they were going to go ahead and stand by Kenny Atkinson. Now, anybody who follows me knows that I about had enough after watching this team get swept, and I was not necessarily I wasn't a fan of that decision. But me being the eternal optimist that I am, me trying to get away from the emotional aspect of watching them get swept, I understand it, especially if the team itself, the players at the top, and James Harden and Donovan Mitchell, Evan Mobley, et cetera, if they are bought in on Kenny as the coach, then it doesn't matter what I think. And I'm willing to have an open mind in regards to year three from Kenny, considering that technically there has been progress made. But I am curious to hear your thoughts on why you think this made sense for the Cavaliers to retain Kenny.
I don't know that it did. but I'll say a few things. Well, first, when you tweeted out this Kenny Atkinson news is going to hit right like crack, is that the news you were expecting?
No. Obviously, I think I had a feeling. I had a feeling deep down that Dan Gilbert, based upon his affinity for Kenny, and I totally understand that, right? I get if the owner has this huge belief in you that he's going to go ahead and give you another opportunity if you get them to a place they haven't been in 8 or so years. I totally understand that aspect to it, but that was not the news that I was expecting.
So I'll say a few things. One, absolutely, I think Dan played a factor in this, a key factor. When you're hired by the owner, that plays a role. It's always easier to fire somebody else hired. So we see it with GMs with previous draft picks. We'd see it with GMs when they come in and take over an inherited coach. It's easy to fire a guy like that. But when you're the owner and you said, I wanted Kenny as my guy, that's a little bit harder. We also saw him post-game, one of the clips after the Pistons game, saying this is the second happiest day he's had since owning the team. That means something to him. So, you know, that I think definitely played a big factor in it. When you look at the coaching market too, was there anybody you can say was a clear upgrade over Kenny? Now that doesn't mean you should keep Kenny, keeping head coaches, because the grass may not always be greener, but I don't think, especially with Michael Malone going to UNC, that would have been a home run, no doubt about it. But after that, is there any of the guys out there you really can say, yes, he would have done better with this roster and yes, would have had them go farther? I don't know. And so then when you combine that with the thing with Dan, and then like you mentioned, Donovan and James came out pretty strong in Kenny's defense. You can say, don't believe what they say. They're lying. It's the season. You know, they're going to say whatever they want to say, but they were in unison. Like, I don't think you probably have a lot of time to talk to another about what you're going to say. So the fact they both came out pretty strongly about that. But even so, and going through, you know, we clip a lot of the post-game pressers. It was pretty consistent that anytime you heard Kenny say something about what went wrong during the game or what he saw, Donovan, James, Evan, whomever it may be, they were pretty in line when saying the same exact thing. And it was pretty consistent throughout the playoffs. And they also had every opportunity to throw Kenny under the bus, especially after game one, especially after some of the decisions that they made, but they didn't. So when you factored in all those things, the player support was there, which is what got JB fired in the first place, but Donovan won't say that, we will. When you have the player support there, when you have the owner still belief there, and when you have not a lot of good alternative options, I think ultimately it came back to this year being so important. And you can say also it's harder to expect a coach to win in year one. What is Mike Brown doing? May not be, you know, the case all the time, but I think all those things kind of led to it, not just one thing or another.
Yeah, I mean, and you raise good points, right? I think that anytime you fire a coach, you probably want to have somebody in mind. I mean, it doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes a guy is let go and the team is just like, you know what? Fuck it. We're going to try and see if we find, we're going to interview enough people. And if we get the right feeling from a specific candidate, then we're going to roll that way. And during this offseason, there are candidates out there that I would have been interested in, but nobody clear cut that I could definitively say that would have been an upgrade over Kenny Atkinson. It would have been just getting a new voice in house. And that was the type of thing that I wanted to go with. Like I see the Micah Norris of the world, the Sean Sweeney's, right? Mm-hmm. The James Borregos and company, right? I see those types and I wonder to myself whether or not it made sense just to get a new voice in that locker room. But at the end of the day, if the players have placed their vote of confidence in Kenny Atkinson, then I'm willing to give it another go. Just wasn't in the moment, not even 12, 24 hours after they got swept. I just didn't feel that I wanted to hear that. But I totally understand it. Being an emotional, maybe sometimes overreactional fan. Once that's out the way, I'm ready to get rolling. And then obviously there's a lot of decisions to be made. And the Cavaliers obviously do not have a lot of assets to work with, which is going to play a role here. But we'll just go on down the line here. It's been reported that James Harden is going to return to the Cleveland Cavaliers on, I'm assuming, a two-year deal. We'll see what ends up happening there. But from a contractual standpoint, just a number standpoint, because you're way deeper into this than I am, from, you know, just looking at the salary cap table and whatnot, what do you think makes the most sense for the Cleveland Cavaliers? And then what do you think would make the most sense for James Harden in terms of looking for that next contract?
James Harden's always going to want what's best for James Harden. I can't believe that.
Yeah.
There hasn't been a lot of times he's taken less money. There's been in some circumstances he's taken less money, but the reason why he moved down from the Clippers and wanted to trade is because the Clippers weren't willing to guarantee that next year and didn't want to extend him. So that right there should tell you kind of what his expectations are. You know, Bobby Marks came out with his projection, which was about a $28 million extension per year. So $28 million this year, $20 million next year. He's due to make a little over $40 million here moving forward. My guess is you're probably going to see something closer in the middle. 28 seems a little bit low. I know people will have their opinions based off of the postseason, but it seems a little bit low. Wouldn't be surprised if it's somewhere in between there. You know, one of the key things that his contract brings is flexibility as far as the cap goes. So right now, without their first round pick, they're about $200,000 over the second apron. Depending on how low he's able to take that contract, if it could be about $13 million off his cap number for this offseason, which is about $42 million, you're getting into a place where you're then below the first apron. One of the biggest things being below the first apron does is it allows you to start doing sign-in trades, allows you to start taking back more money in a deal and a trade. They have consequences such as hard capping you where then you can't go across that threshold, but at least gets you down to that point. Then if you do that, plus you do something like Max's contract, you do something like Dennis's contract, then it starts to get a little bit more interesting and your flexibility increases. So what his deal looks like, it's going to be lower than the $42 million. He's got $13 million guaranteed no matter what he does. So if the Cavs were to waive him or decline his option, or you know, if they're to waive him, then it's still on the books and it doesn't resign. And one of the biggest things I would say as far as people saying they should let him walk, you know, don't pay him anything. What's the alternative? Like you mentioned, there are limited ways to get better. And if the goal of next year is to compete, the delta between what you're getting with James Harden and what the alternative is simply not worth it. And so in a vacuum, Yes, he had his mistakes. I think he also did a lot better than maybe some expected, or at least some of the numbers expect. But all analytically, we'll say analytically, you know, but ultimately, he's probably going to come back, on a lower number to increase that flexibility. But ultimately, they've kind of backed themselves into the corner with James to an extent. And if you're trying to compete, you're at that point.
Yeah. I mean, what's the alternative? That's really what this boils down to. I mean, you can look at that trade in every, whatever POV you want. Maybe it was more so, hey, we don't really like Darius Garland's impending contract, and we're going to try and move off of him and get somebody where we do have a little bit more flexibility in terms of that next deal. Maybe you see it as they were never going to get as far as they got with Darius Garland, and James Harden allows them a quicker pivot into the future. I don't know. But as of right now, there are limited assets, and you don't really have real ways to replace the level of production that James Harden, even as flawed as he is at this stage of his career, you don't have avenues to generally replace that, genuinely speaking. I mean, you look at the on-off numbers, you know, and you'll find various sets of numbers wherever you look, but even, you know, Databaller hasn't met the Cavaliers were plus 4.3 when he was on the floor during the playoffs, and minus 11.3 when factoring in low leverage and stuff like that. The Cavaliers are clearly better with him on the court than off of it, regardless of the turnovers, regardless of the defense, regardless of some of the other issues out there in terms of the offensive flow. So you really don't have too many other choices but to bring him back. But I've seen so many different people suggest that they let him walk, and I just don't understand that. And then on the other side of this, in the backcourt, is Donovan Mitchell, right? This, suffice to say, I don't think anybody was really satisfied with the postseason run that we got from Donovan overall, but he had his moments. And I can always appreciate when an athlete, especially in this city, comes out and says, I love this city, and you know, I'm going to play for you guys as long as I can. There's obviously more context that goes into that. But with Donovan and the looming decision that that he has with the player option and whatnot coming up in the future, I got to ask you right off the bat, just personally, 75 something million dollars he could potentially earn in the next year or two. How would you feel about paying Donovan Mitchell that much money, you know, heading towards the latter stages of his career?
It's not my money, so it's a lot easier. But
the diplomatic
not great.
Approach, I guess.
Yeah. not great. You know, we've seen Mitchell is very much a player that's dependent on his athleticism, probably more than others. He's not going to win by size. He's got long arms, but he's more so explosive. We've seen what that lack of explosiveness has done in the playoffs at times. So when you're betting on a guy to overcome the athleticism as he gets older, and we've seen the limitations that has had in the playoffs at times, that starts to make you nervous. His assist percentage over the last four playoffs have decreased every single year. So when you talk about playmaking, that's been an issue. You know, and I, one of the things that it gets back to is, what can you definitively say Donovan does to raise the floor of those around him and make the team better when he's not scoring? I think that's the biggest issue within this as well. If he was like a LeBron, where when he's not, doesn't have a good shooting, he's defending well, he's rebounding well, he's getting others involved, you could probably live with that $75 million, because you know you're the avenues to success and validating that contract can happen in a multitude of ways. With Donovan, what we've seen in the postseason is that that avenue for success for validating that contract is so very limited to the scoring, and we've seen that scoring be degraded by injury. We've also seen that scoring be degraded by matchups. And so when you think about that, it's kind of scary to think of what that can be. And I don't know, kind of similar to James, the Cavs have backed themselves into a corner to an extent. If they're committing to being better next year, how are you better without Donovan? But also the leverage he has over you is probably more than the leverage you have over him. Anytime a player has a player option, they determine their next steps more than the team does. We're seeing that with Giannis. The Giannis market is probably going to be limited to the teams that he wants to go to. Same with Donovan. If the Cavs don't want Donovan, the market for him is probably going to be limited to what teams he'd want to go to. So when you put it all together, you know, it's not a great choice, but I think similar to Harden, it's probably the lesser of all evils if next year's goal is to compete.
I think that's what it boils down to. What do the Cavaliers prefer to do? If this is the season that they're saying, you know what, we're going to go all in and we're going to push every chip that we have to the table to go for one last playoff run during this current iteration of the team, I think you don't really have any other choices. You can explore trades for Donovan, considering he's probably your most attractive trade asset outside of maybe Evan Mobley, considering how other teams view him. But at the end of the day, I think some value is lost. Obviously, he is aging. He has the player option for 2027-28. I just think that so many different factors are working against the Cavaliers right now that they kind of have to keep him if the expectation is to compete for a title in 2026-27. But even Donovan, right? These two big dominoes in terms of the backcourt, that's the crazy thing. It's not even the only thing that the Cavaliers are having to weigh this.
Hi, it's Sierra Miller. I can't wait for you to check out my new collection of shoes and accessories at Designer Shoe Warehouse. If you love shoes as much as I do, then trust me, I got you. From cute sneakerinas to the perfect flip-flops to stunning heels, these shoes are all style, no drama. It's a girl's girl summer, and DSW has just the shoes. Shop the Sierra Miller collection right now at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Offseason, you get to the Evan Mobley of it all. That conversation is huge because obviously it's linked to the one name that you just mentioned that everybody else is kind of waiting around, twiddling their thumbs and trying to figure out what the Cavaliers are going to do, because it does appear that the ball is kind of in Cleveland's court right now. Giannis, on paper, if you're just stacking talent for talent, Donovan Mitchell, James Harden, Giannis, if you're lucky enough to keep Jared Allen and some of these other pieces, I know you've probably broken down the numbers standpoint of what it would take to make a deal like that work, whether or not it's just a one-for-one swap and whatnot. But if you're just stacking the talent on paper and you're looking at that alone, that's a lot of talent. But fit, to me, matters. I just don't know. Maybe you can sell me on this. I don't know what your mindset is in reference to Giannis. But if you add Giannis to the Cleveland Cavaliers as presently constructed, does that work from a fit standpoint, in your opinion, if you're swapping Evan for Giannis?
So going back to the LeBron era, I think one thing that bringing three talented players together teaches you is there's going to be sacrifice and who's going to sacrifice. Kevin Love was the one that had to sacrifice the most, and even he had issues with it throughout his tenure. In the iteration of, say, Giannis, Donovan Mitchell, and James Harden, who's going to sacrifice?
They're all
going
to I think it would have to be Donovan. Obviously you're gonna need sacrifices between all of them, but I think the person that would sacrifice the most in the situation might very well be Donovan because of the off-ball viability. Neither James or Donovan are great off-ball players, in my opinion, but of the two, I still think there's still some untapped potential at the very least in Donovan. And if you're going to take the ball out of somebody's hands and make somebody the off-guard, It's Donovan, but I have my reservations on whether or not that is a egg that I want to place into the basket. So I just don't know how I feel about that. And then there's the space and concerns of it all, but I'll let you continue. I just had to throw it out there.
It's a great point. And we look back at these last few years of Cavaliers offseason. They've replaced the head coach. They've changed out role players. They've even stripped away some of the core. They've done everything they possibly can, understanding the role players haven't always performed, understanding Kenny lost them game one in the Eastern Conference Finals. They've done everything they can except address the biggest elephant in the room, which is the very top of the totem pole. And that's typically what you do, right? Before you go stripping away your very best player, you try to work around the edge to see if it works. We're now at a point where you seriously have to consider, can you win with Donovan Mitchell being your best player? Can you win with Evan Mobley being your second best player? And I think what Giannis does more than anything else is he trumps any other player you have and automatically bumps everyone else on the totem pole to a place where maybe they're best suited to get to where the Cavs want to get to. We look back to the Cavaliers championship team. Donovan Mitchell in a Kyrie Irving type role is perfect for who he is. Go out there, score, get us buckets. Don't worry about anything else. Giannis doesn't have the playmaking in LeBron, obviously. But, you know, I think him being able to more so focus on what he does best and not have to worry about doing everything else may help. And ultimately, I think that's the biggest selling point of Giannis is we've seen Giannis be the best player and win in championships. You know that is a successful formula, even going, later in his career, now with some calf injuries. but that formula of what you had isn't working, and this may change the formula to an extent that it could work. So I think that's the biggest selling point. Like you mentioned, the spacing concerns, the fit concerns, the sacrifice concerns, those are all there. But again, what are the other options that they have if they're trying to compete next year?
No, you're right. And that's like when you look at both sides of this, right? And I've had many discussions with people about it. If the Cavaliers did end up trading for Giannis and we had to say goodbye to Evan Mobley, I would be heartbroken for like 5 seconds. And then I would eventually move on to like, hey, man, we got fucking Giannis. And we'd figure out a way to make it work, at least in theory. But the reservations for me are very valid, right? We're talking about Giannis is like 35% usage rate and up most seasons. And James Harden, he's not sacrificing much in terms of off ball and being taken off the rock that much. You did see the usage decrease during the regular season. You saw it prop back up during the postseason as expected. But when you look back at those Cavaliers teams, right, it was LeBron and it was Kyrie at the high usage. And Love was obviously off ball most of the time. You're talking about three guys who essentially could be 30% usage rate or have operated that way and above in your starting lineup, with that fourth and fifth starter having to sacrifice tremendous amounts of touches to those guys. And the one thing that Love had going for him is that he could space the floor. So There's definitely a lot of concerns there. I understand that adding somebody like a Giannis, who was like the generational rim pressure type of player, he could drive to the basket, get through the wall of the defense on the interior and dunk it home over XYZ player in the post. I understand that. I understand that he collapses defenses, which would theoretically open up the perimeter shot making. But even that, right? The Cavaliers have frankly sucked ass in terms of knocking down shots these last couple of playoff runs. I think they shot something like 29% from three-point distance against New York. They shot 32% or something like that over the course of this postseason in general. And even harkening back to last postseason, the series against the Pacers, it continues to haunt, because not only are the players at the top and your James Hardens and your Donovan Mitchell struggling to consistently knock down that three-point shot, but your role players are not bringing you much either. So to me, if you're going to make a move like that, it's obviously from a fit and spacing standpoint going to necessitate additional moves, which I think would always likely be the case, to kind of tailor the fit around Giannis, try and figure out where he fits best, whether you're going to play him at the four or you're going to try and attempt to play him at the five and get a stretch four out there, or you do a stretch five. I don't know, but there's a lot of question marks. As I mentioned, if you did go down that route, I could sell myself on the idea of it simply because of the talent alone. But man, that would be as boom or bust as it gets in terms of the fit. And then obviously beyond that, the one name that is forever linked to Cleveland, no matter where he goes, LeBron. I've seen you do extensive work. You guys have really put together a lot in terms of what that could potentially look like in terms of sign and trades. Care to shed some light on why that would make sense for the Cavaliers and why you think it potentially would not make sense for the Cavaliers, just looking at both sides?
One of the best reasons it makes sense is that he potentially could come for free. For a team with limited assets, if you can get a player like that for free, essentially, you know, through the free agent market, how could you not take that option?
Even
in his 40s, he's played at an elite level. We've still seen him give flashes of old LeBron. He's not the defender he once was, but still can impact the game in so many different ways. I think one of the biggest things that he could provide this team is more than on court, it's off court. Be the leadership, be the head of the snake, hold guys accountable. If Donovan and James aren't getting the bigs involved, you damn well know that LeBron's going to say, get the bigs involved and it's going to happen. So I think more than anything else, the things you can't quantify is kind of the best assets that he potentially brings. And we saw kind of lacking at times. One of the difficulties with bringing LeBron is we don't know what he's going to want salary wise. No matter what he wants, there's going to sacrifice is a word of this pod, I guess. LeBron coming to Cleveland means somebody's sacrificed. It might mean both sides sacrifice, but both sides to an extent have to sacrifice. And it's a question of who's willing to sacrifice more. If LeBron comes for a veteran minimum, great. There's no sacrifice there for the Cavs, but LeBron sacrificed all of his financial to come be in the situation. If LeBron comes for a salary above the taxpayer mid-level or somewhere around that, that means the Cavs would have to sacrifice players such as Strus, Jared Allen, Dennis Schroeder, whomever you want to throw in to make that salary work. In addition to any time you complete a sign-in trade or use a signing exception, such as the taxpayer mid-level or the non-taxpayer mid-level, you're hard capped, meaning you cannot exceed that amount for any reason and cannot unfreeze it moving forward. That likely means Keon Ellis isn't re-signed. It means Dean Wade isn't re-signed. Even though you have bird rights to those guys, meaning you can go above the cap to re-sign them, when you're hard capped, that goes out the window. So one of the difficulties of LeBron's scenarios is, yes, you can likely get to his number, but what does that number mean for the rest of your roster after you get there? So say, you know, go through a quick scenario. Say James Harden drops down to get below the first apron. So you need to get below the first apron in order to execute a sign and trade. It can't just be below the second apron. It has to be below the first apron. James Harden re-signing for a $28 million deal gets you right there. Okay. At that point, you need to then shed additional money to pay whatever you want to sign LeBron. If it's for the non-taxpayer mid-level, that means you need to shed at least $15 million to sign him. You do that, you're then hard capped. You have no room to improve, and you only have 9 to 11 guys, depending on who you make, who you move to make it have happen. What are you going to do to sign four or five guys to reach the 14-player minimum if you have no space? I mean, shedding more players. And then even to add players back, you're limited to what you can add because of the, you know, the roster limits that you have and the limited financial flexibility you have. So it kind of gets to, if LeBron wants as much money as he does, it strips so much away of the Cavs being competitive, you get to a point of saying, is it worth it? You know, you're going to have varying levels of people saying yes because of LeBron, but ultimately, you know, I would hope if LeBron has interest in coming home, he's a smart enough guy, he knows the league well enough that the less money he takes, the more competitive the roster can be. The more money he takes, the less competitive the roster will be. Doesn't mean they won't be able to compete, but I think that's the balance, is who's going to sacrifice if LeBron comes home. Someone has to, and the question is, who does?
How many billionaires you know are willing to sacrifice? I think that's the biggest question. Yeah, I mean, obviously you're spot on. LeBron, if he was operating from a space of, I really think this is my best choice or best chance to win a title, which I think it clearly would be, at least in the Eastern Conference from the available teams that could offer him a spot, in my opinion. I mean, all teams would probably try and get LeBron if they could, but you understand what I'm trying to say. If LeBron viewed it as an opportunity truly where this is his best shot, I think that sacrifice would be warranted because he would know that filling it out with playable depth is a very important thing. And this Cleveland Cavaliers team has been snake bitten in that regard over the years when it comes to the playoffs. As much as I like the Craig Porter Jr.'s and the Thomas Bryant's and the Naquan Tomlin, and, you know, I think Naquan's going to be something if they give him the developmental reps that he needs. Players like that, clearly you want to be operating from a place of playable depth. And obviously you need assets to be able to bring that in. You need money to be able to bring some of these guys in. The Cavaliers are not flush with either of those things. So it would behoove LeBron, if he truly sees this as a great opportunity, to sacrifice. But based upon the reporting, based upon what we're seeing, I just don't think that's the case. I'm not ruling it out by any stretch of the imagination because we're so early on. But I would have to think that if LeBron is asking for a certain amount, I don't know how worth it would be for Cleveland at the end of the day, because you would essentially gut your roster just to try and make it work around the top guys. And you see how often that fails. This new NBA, this structure we have, depth is so important. When you look at teams like San Antonio and OKC and Indiana in recent years and New York, I mean, just look at the guys who are contending right now, the teams that are contending right now, they're all pretty heavy on depth, and they all are willing to sacrifice to varying degrees in terms of on the court out there. So I don't know. And then you have the big question mark of what you're going to do with some of the role players. Max Strus obviously comes to the forefront just because of the salary that he's due to make next season. That could be a pretty decent bargaining chip if the Cavaliers are looking to improve along the margins, I suppose. Jared Allen, I'm sure that there are still some somebody out there that will be willing to take on his contract and whatnot, because he is a very talented big if used correctly. I think it just really depends upon what the Cavaliers' priorities are and where they lie in terms of how you shore up some of these flaws. Because if you don't go the route of bringing in Giannis, if you don't end up bringing back LeBron, what is the best avenue to improvement? How do you shore up some of these flaws? How do you get more athletic out on the wings? How do you bring in more depth in your front court? So I guess my next question for you would be, is if they strike out on Giannis, or rather they decline the opportunity to bring him in and LeBron is just off the table, what would be the next best thing you think the Cavaliers could do to improve some of the very noticeable flaws on this roster?
Hope and pray.
That's probably accurate.
I say that jokingly, but I mean, you know, you talked about the limited assets. Like, even if James Harden takes less and they get below the first apron, you're still limited to what you can do. Once you're above the first apron, you need the taxpayer mid-level exception. It's only $6 million. You use that. You're hard capped at the second apron. So, you know, that's only like $7 more million between that taxpayer mid-level and the second apron if you're operating from the bottom of the first apron. That's not going to get you much in the free agent market or just anywhere else. You know, obviously opens up.
You know that thing where you get an amazing pair of shoes at a really great price and want to tell everyone about it? Yeah, so do we. Here at Designer Shoe Warehouse, we'll give you something to brag about. Like the latest styles from brands you love, or the trends everyone's obsessing over, or shoes that make you feel like, well, you. So go ahead, show off a little. Find shoes that get you at prices that get your budget. Head to your DSW store or DSW.com today. DSW, let us surprise you.
Trade possibilities, but you're really limited. So I think their kind of decision tree is going from top to bottom as far as thinking, if we're not going to get those guys, okay, what does Evan Mobley get us? You may not want to trade him, but is it a Jaylen Brown? Is it a Jaylen Williams? Is it someone else that, you know, type of player? What does he get us? Okay, if that's not available, what does Jared Allen get us? I think you just kind of keep working your way down the food chain and trying to understand what level does trading them make us better. So we'll see what names start to pop up. But I think ultimately with all those names that we talked about, they're going to have to choose the Cavs. I don't know that it's much as the Cavs choosing them. I think Giannis is going to control his destination, and he's not going anywhere that he's not going to want to go to and sign a long-term extension with. No team's going to offer their best package for a Giannis on a one-year rental. Maybe they do. Maybe the Cavs do it as a Kawhi Leonard situation. They're willing to go all in, but Evan Mobley for that price is a high, high, high price to pay. No matter how confident you are they're winning, that's a high price to pay for just 1 year. LeBron, same thing. You know, ultimately, he's going to have to choose them to some extent of where he wants to go. They'll make it work if he says, I'm going to sign for a taxpayer mid-level. You damn well sure that Dan Gilbert's going to make sure it's going to work somehow. So I think all these options that are going to depend on the Cavs being chosen and not the Cavs being choosing of who they want to go after. But ultimately, you know, I think playable size is the biggest thing that they need to improve upon moving forward in the offseason. You look at all the teams that are left remaining, all different wing options, size options they have out there. We were trying to ask Dean Wade to be everything that he's not and fill multiple holes at once, be our starting two-way wing, be our backup four, you know, and love Dean Wade, but that's a lot being asked of him, knowing the type of player that he is. So I think moving forward, playable depth should be the number one thing that if they track on some of those top guys, improving their playable depth on the wings behind Jared Allen, Evan Mobley to better complement them and better complement the team, that's really the number one thing they have to look at.
There are options in reference to guys who could be let to walk, and you just mentioned one of them, Dean Wade. Do you entertain bringing back Dean Wade if you were the Cleveland Cavaliers, knowing everything you know about Dean Wade? Do you think it makes sense for the Cavaliers to retain the services of Dean Wade?
Depends on the price of Dean Wade. So we saw last offseason, there was some trade discussion with Dean Wade in Houston Rockets before they went and signed Dorian Finney-Smith. They had interest in signing Dean Wade to a very similar full non-taxpayer mid-level exception, which this year that's around $15 million. I'm not sure you can justify a Dean being worth $15 million to this team, no matter how important of a role he plays. That's a lot of money to spend based off of kind of where you're at now. You know, I think one of the things to consider, though, too, is that if they are above the second apron, they can go as high as they want into the second apron because they're not hard capped. So yes, the second apron is a bad thing, but it's also a good thing in that if you have your own players you want to retain, like Keenan Ellis, like Dean Wade, you can go as high as you possibly want. So that then depends on Dan, how much he wants to spend. So there is some flexibility in the second apron that you have, you don't have in the first apron or below, as far as potentially being hard capped by using some of the exceptions. You know, going back and looking at Dean, so we kind of did an analysis of players based off of production, his age level, and kind of what we looked at historically over the last 10, 15 years was Wade's market is likely to be a 2 to 3 year deal, totaling around, you know, like 17, 19 million dollars, or $25 to $28 million. So somewhere in that like $8 to $10 million average annual value range is kind of where the market tended to go for those type of players. One of the interesting things in looking at some of the historical production for Dean Wade is that archetypal role player at that age that Wade is at, so late 20s, early 30s, based off of the market, is there's been historically a very sharp fall off after about 2 years. So even if they do re-sign him, is it a two-year deal plus a non-guaranteed plus a team option, you know, whatever it may be, I think flexibility is important within that. But I think based off of the market is that, I'd be surprised if Dean comes back, because it likely means taking a discount and likely bypassing a lot of really, really good offers. But even within that, the Cavs simply may not be afford to take him back if they're looking at additional flexibility elsewhere.
Before this season began, I was a huge proponent of this has got to be the last season of Dean Wade. And that's is coming from somebody who's a really big fan of Dean Wade. But I had really grown to appreciate the developmental window of Naquan Tomlin. I loved what I saw out of him during the summer league. And obviously that environment is much less pressurized. I thought that he had a pretty tremendous opportunity on his hands in the early stages of the regular season. And I thought he earned his new deal. And then there was kind of a fall off in regard to that. But at the end of the day, I saw the potential that Tomlin had. And I just thought to myself, okay, Dean's got to walk. And then you have all these deals that are made, and Dean is really your best option in terms of point of attack defense at times. He's the one guy you feel comfortable putting on a Jalen Brunson and some of the better perimeter players out there while still retaining enough defensive versatility to play up against bigger forwards out there. So the importance of a Dean Wade for this specific iteration of the Cavaliers, sometimes it's hard to truly quantify how impactful or how important a guy like that is to have on the roster. But when you are not flush with assets, when you're trying to weigh how much this guy actually deserves on this next deal, I just don't know how much sense it makes to keep him in-house. But again, this is all dependent upon whether or not you're able to get one of those bigger pieces. And then obviously, the other big acquisition at the deadline being Keon Ellis, another player that I really had high hopes for, but was ultimately disappointed in. But I don't really know, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure you have your own thoughts and opinions on Keon Ellis, but I just felt like he wasn't given a true opportunity this postseason. I thought that obviously Kenny went to the guys he trusted, and I understand that. Max Strus, Sam Merrill, Dean Wade, Jalen Tyson at times. I totally understand going with the guys that you probably feel most comfortable in giving you the opportunities to win. But I often thought that that left Keon Ellis kind of out in the cold in a season in which obviously you acquired him. That was supposed to be one of the bigger points of this rotation in the second half of the season. It just did not pan out that way, which kind of sucked on multiple fronts, because not only did you give up on DeAndre Hunter, and that's a whole nother conversation because of the salary of it all, but you really were left feeling as if you didn't get a lot from that, because Dennis was so up and down. Keon was, I guess, unplayable, or Kenny just didn't want to put him out there. And, now you're at a crossroads where you have to figure out what we're doing with this guy. If you are the Cleveland Cavaliers, what is the case for signing Keon Ellis to an extension?
Ask Kenny that. So I think he can be the driver of kind of where that goes. But
yeah,
it's kind of ironic that so much of the last couple of years has been, there's been so much positional overlap in the backcourt and on the wing. Kobe has been known to kind of be a guard collector. Shout out to David Kahn, you know, after David Kahn, now there's Kobe Alwyn to an extent. But, you know, I think one of the issues in playing Keon is not in so much as Keon himself, but just the optionality around Keon. So when you brought Keon and L and Schroeder in and you swapped out Hunter, you took away a lot of your playable size and provide a lot of overlap in the backcourt where there's only so many minutes to go around at the 1, 2, and 3 position, especially when two of your best players at the 1 and 2 position are going to be taking up a lot of those minutes. So
and you got Dennis so many, out there. Yep.
Yeah. And there's only so many minutes to go around. There's also only so many of those guys who can scale up, you know, even Tyson and Strus, you're not wanting them to scale up, but they had to scale up more than you probably wanted to, because you need to facilitate minutes for other guys. So it really depends on what you're committed to behind your starters. If you're bringing back Max, you're bringing back Sam, you're bringing back Dennis, like there's really not room for Keon. Ultimately, I don't think financially they're going to be able to bring all those guys back. You're probably looking at 2, maybe 3 of Max, Dean, Sam, Keon, Dennis. Like there's too much non-production and positional overlap in that middle class of the salary cap that they have that they just cannot afford anymore. And they're probably going to be moving off either to get better or to get more flexible. So I think bringing Keon back depends on what you plan to do with everyone else around him. There's an avenue to bringing him back because anytime you have positional defense like that, especially where the Cavs are at, you know, that's attractive to bring in. He's probably a much better shooter than he showed in the playoffs. Historically, he's way above Isaac Okoro as far as volume and accuracy goes. So I don't think the one-to-one comparison is there. There's some limitation with him on the ball. So what you're able to do limits maybe that value you have for him. But ultimately, I think if they bring him back, it says more about what they plan to do around him. And one other thing I'll mention about Keon is Donovan's lack of playmaking had a domino effect on the rest of the roster. Not only did it not elevate the roster to the place it needed to be, but it also made a role for Dennis Schroeder that maybe wouldn't have been there otherwise if Donovan's playmaking would have been there. So I know people like to hate on Kenny for putting Schroeder in. I think he was good in some spots, but ultimately, if you want to be mad at someone about Dennis playing, you should be mad at Donovan, because we saw Point Donovan so often and worked well. When it came to the playoffs, it didn't work. And that lack of playmaking and the offense cratering when Harden wasn't on the floor forced Kenny needed another ball handler. Dennis was the best ball handler. And it took away minutes from a Jalen Tyson, took away minutes from a Keon Ellis. So I think you're going to have to solve for that within the complex of the roster. But ultimately, you bring him back, it just depends on price and depends on what you're doing to all the other role players.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, again, it all circles back to some of the flaws that Donovan Mitchell and others on this roster have. It really was pretty damning out there at times, seeing some of these lineups that Kenny, I guess you could argue, was kind of forced at times to play out there to try and compensate for some of those deficiencies at times. And it kind of begs the question, is it a Kenny issue or is it a roster construction issue or is it both? Which may be why, in fact, Kenny was given a third year. And I guess I'll end things by asking you this one simple question, because I've seen this posed a number of times on YouTube and across various social media outlets. The Cavaliers, the reasons why they lost that series, is there any realm that you see this team, if taking the coaching out of it, did they have any real shot to beat New York as presently constructed? Did you believe in your heart of hearts that this team could presently, as presently constructed, have defeated the New York Knicks?
My heart didn't want to believe what my eyes were seeing. I think that's the analysis. I mean, going in, you thought the Cavs had a chance. I think game one proved it. Like there were some answers or things that the Knicks were doing that the Cavs had early on. But no, taking coaching out of it, you probably win game one. After that, the Knicks were on a historical heater. The Cavs' shot-making dwindled compared to the Knicks. I think the Knicks, they're shooting about 53% from the field.
Through that freaking Landry Shamit, man.
Steve Kerr, you mean? They shot below 50% from the field just 3 times, and 2 of those times were 49%. The Cavs, I think, only shot two or three times over 50% over their last 11 playoff games. So just shot-making differential alone, that's hard to overcome. not when you talk about all the different scoring margin issues. So points off turnovers, they were 23.5 per game. That would be worse than the regular season. Fast break points are at about 19 points per game they're giving up. That would have been worse than the regular season. Points in the paint, they were getting decimated there. That's the one leverage point that they had against both teams in double big lineups. The whole point, they weren't often able to leverage that. So you take coaching out of it, that's a tough series based off of how the Cavs were playing shot-making-wise, but also how the Knicks were playing shot-making-wise. And ultimately, the Knicks had the best player in the series. When you don't have the best player and your best players aren't playing like your best players, it doesn't matter what your old players are doing, it doesn't matter what your coach is doing, it's hard to win any playoff series.
I think that's probably as succinct as you could put it, honestly. I mean, seriously, Luca, like, I entered that series with high hopes. You know, I was very boisterous on social media. Oh, we're going to, you know, you ain't seen nothing like this Cavaliers offense, Atlanta, Philly. They were nothing compared to Cleveland, all that good stuff, only to fall flat on our asses because the shot making continues to be an issue. And there's little variance in terms of the offense out there at times. Couldn't get comfortable. This is the crazy thing, and people were really shitting on me about this. I didn't necessarily feel as if, from a defensive standpoint, New York, like, clamped. I thought that they played great defense. I thought that they did a lot of things out there at the point of attack that did make life difficult on Donovan Mitchell, especially bringing the ball up the floor. Same things with James Harden, right? Whether that was the doubling and the switches and whatnot. It just – I was not left feeling like – what they did defensively was truly something that the Cavaliers could not have overcome. But the lack of shot making, the inconsistency in terms of the getting the bigs involved, right? We talk about Evan Mobley not being involved in the second half of, I think it was game three or four, game two or three. And then Jared Allen, right? Very, very guard dependent at times. I just thought that there was just so much inconsistency in that series. And I guess none of it truly matters, as you said, if your best player isn't really playing like the best player out there. And that just was not the case. Combine that the fact that New York, as you mentioned, were shooting just what felt like otherworldly at times. Landry Shamet or Steve Kerr knocking down 60%+ of his triples, especially like the contested ones. He was bailing them out so often on driving kicks or the last second shot clock heaves. Like, this guy was out there scorching twine. One of the things, just from an objective standpoint, that was really impressive and has been all playoffs long, has been Karl Anthony Towns playmaking and facilitating out of the high post in from above the arc, where he's literally just able to sit there, be patient, and pinpoint passes to any number of cutters out there. And I think that right there is something that I truly hope that the Cavaliers learn something from, because you saw Jalen Brunson screening. Obviously, you saw Josh Hart, OG. You really just saw everybody screening when they needed to. I need more off-ball activity from our guards. I don't care if you get Giannis, if you get LeBron, whoever else you bring in here. The one thing that I really hope that Kenny Atkinson kind of hammers home this offseason is off-ball movement from our backcourt. Because I think that there, when one is on and you're getting the isolation offense and the other just doesn't have the ball in their hands, it's just far too much stagnation. You're not seeing ball movement from a James Harden. You're not seeing really ball movement from Donovan Mitchell all that often. You're not seeing cuts to the basket. You're not seeing Don go backdoor. You're not seeing him willingly set screens outside of trying to get the ball back into his own hands at times. You're seeing a lot of these things that other players that are as talented or maybe even less talented than them that are willing to do that they are not. So I need them to take accountability for some of these things, or I just think we're going to end up flaming out again. But let me get off my soapbox here. Stop
raining. I just want to add to that real quick, and I'm glad you brought it up, Mac. I thought your post on Karl Anthony Towns and how the Knicks were utilizing him was everything the Cavs needed to do with Evan Mobley. Yeah. That is how you talk about the difference between the two teams. I mean, I think there's a few things. One, the ability to play make from Karl Anthony Towns. Nothing that he did is outside of Mobley's capabilities. That is who I think he needs to be leveraged as more than a scorer, be a playmaker, be a hub. Get some of the guards off the ball, make their job easier. But I thought your post kind of breaking that down with the video clips was excellent. That's exactly what the Cavs need to try to replicate. When you talk about Donovan Mitchell versus Jalen Brunson, I think Donovan Mitchell's pass percentage on drives was like 33%, something in that realm. we saw Jalen Brunson, even when he wasn't shooting well, he had 14, 13 assists early in the series. You know, that's the difference there, that even when Donovan's not playing well or when Jalen isn't playing well, he was able to impact the game in other ways and still elevate his team. Now, Donovan's, you know, if his teammates make shots, it looks a little bit different, but that's another difference right there. And then talking about defensively, I think the way that the Cavs attack things versus the way that Mike Brown attack things, especially a point of attack with the Jalen Brunson, Donovan Mitchell, James Harden matchup, the Cavs were too easily conceding those switches and letting the Knicks get into exactly what they want without deterring it or making them work. On the other end, you had, I thought, like in game four, game three, Mike Brown did a great job getting Jalen off ball, running Dean off screen. So when Jalen was catching, he was catching with an advantage or Dean on his hip, or getting in the switches where the whole point of Dean Wade being on the floor is providing value defensively. Well, if you get an easy switch and get him off him, the value of Dean Wade decreases and your matchup gets easier. And I thought even when they got to those matchups, the way that the Knicks played out of it was a lot better than the way the Cavs played out of it, where you got iso ball, late shot clock, little ball movement. I thought almost the Knicks wanted that matchup because the Cavs, they're better at getting into flow, getting downhill, getting into the paint, kick out, swings. That's where they operate best out of, whereas opposed to iso ball with Donovan and James, that ball is moving like it is. Whereas when the Knicks were doing it, they were passing a lot better out of it. They were getting downhill. They were bringing not only Donovan, but also James into action. I thought the Dunker's Pod did a great spot about that, that they're not only bringing them into action, they're bringing them into action and getting the other one in help side. So even if they got a blow by, you're getting James Harden and Donovan in help, which is a lot different than OG or Mikal Bridges in help. So I thought all those things, just even schematically or the way that they were operating, that was a difference, even more so than shot making, was just how things operated on both ends of the floor.
I knew going into this series, knowing Mike Brown, the defensive-minded tactician that he is and has always been, would probably throw a wrench in things and kind of muck things up. And you'd saw it coming in the prior two series. But what I was hoping for is that Kenny Atkinson would find creative ways to adjust. I mean, you don't get Jalen Brunson going 8 of 12 against James Harden in game one in that what felt like every single shot that he took went in like the final 8 minutes of that game with James consistently being switched upon and the Cavaliers just conceding that. I hated that. I hated to watch that play out. I thought Kenny, as the time went on, got better at not allowing that, but it still was too little.
At DSW, we ask the important questions, like, what shoes are you going to wear? Whether you're prepping for wedding season, festival season, or just planning the ultimate vacay, the right shoes can make or break an RSVP. So own the moment. You've got big plans and we've got just the shoes. At the perfect price, of course. Get ready to get ready with Designer Shoe Warehouse. Head to your DSW store or DSW.com today and let us surprise you.
Too late at points. And then Donovan, one of the most frustrating things about Donovan to me, Luca, is that he's capable of making a lot of these passes that we want him to make. And we have seen him do it. The entry passes, the driving kicks, the lobs, the wraparounds, right? There's just so the dump balls. Yeah, the dump offs, getting the bigs involved, all of these different things that James Harden is capable of. Somebody who, honestly, I hate to bring this name up, I know we're going long-winded here, but somebody who was really good at doing some of these things was Caris LeVert. And he was very, very inconsistent at it too, especially dump off passes. But you know that Donovan Mitchell is a capable passer, but some part of me just feels like it is mental for him. Like he wants to take on the challenge of outscoring the opposing team. And that is what's so frustrating to me, because I've seen him do these things. He just does not do them consistently. And that, if anything else, for all the flaws that James Harden has, is what I appreciate, because he will look to get the ball to a Jared Allen. He will look to try and force feed to Evan Mobley, even if some of his passes just miss the mark by a mile. And that's another thing, right? Some of these long passes to try and take advantage of the size, to try and get New York over the top with some of these like down the court lobs and passes. That was really frustrating too in this series, because New York is not a team that you could have afforded to turn the basketball over against like that. They will make you pay for it, similar to how Toronto and Detroit did. But at the end of the day, all of this, led to the Cavaliers getting to a point at which they have not gotten to in 8 years. So I have no choice at the very least to
to at least feel and take solace in that. But I don't know if there's ever quite been a playoffs, at least for this current iteration, that has somehow felt like success and failure at the same time. I mean, obviously, the goal is championship. So anytime you don't win a championship, there is some form of failure that applies. But from just a mentality standpoint, from a mindset of the general fan base, I think people feel like this was a success, or you've taken a step in the direction, but you've also feel like they failed at the same time in a major way. I don't know if that's how you feel, but I feel like it's just both extremes combining for one, and it just feels so deflating.
I think even in the wins, you thought they could have played better. And I think that's the biggest thing, is the unfulfilled potential that I think all fans knew and saw them at times play, that they never were able to reach that. We saw them reach that, but their inability to get to that level consistently, even though we knew it had it in them, was the most frustrating thing. You know, I think their wins are a lot like Taco Bell. Like, you're going to enjoy it at the moment, but you're going to regret it later, because, you know, it feels great then, but you know you're going to pay for it later. And that's almost what it felt like, is that even in the moment, you know it was good, but it wasn't fulfilling, because you know it was to come. So it was just hard to watch from the aspect of, they played great. Like, this is what happens for non-LeBron playoff teams. Like, it's going to be a struggle. It's going to be a grind. But there is so much unfulfilled potential for things that we saw them do that they didn't do consistently. And it just left kind of a bad taste in your mouth, even though they got to where I think most people expect them or want them to at least get to. When you throw in some of the injuries in the Eastern Conference, it kind of made it that much more of a sour taste. But ultimately, yes, it's successful. No, it didn't end the way you wanted to, because there was a lot more in the tank that, you know, they had, they never were able to get to.
Yeah. 8 wins, 10 losses just does not even feel right for a team that made it to the Eastern Conference final. That's crazy to me. But thanks as always for joining the show on such short notice, Luke. I appreciate you, man.
Yeah. Appreciate you. And if you're not already, make sure you hit the subscribe button, listen, tap into the podcast, follow Mac. You're missing out if you're not.
Hey, appreciate the plug, and make sure you guys do the same, as if you're not already doing that. And if you're in this community for real Cavs fans, they do great work over there, including Luca. Alrighty, go Cavs. Have a good night.
At DSW, we ask the important questions, like, what shoes are you going to wear? Whether you're prepping for wedding season, festival season, or just planning the ultimate vacay, the right shoes can make or break an RSVP. So own the moment. You've got big plans, and we've got just the shoes. At the perfect price, of course. Get ready to get ready with Designer Shoe Warehouse. Head to your DSW store or DSW.com today, and let us surprise you.